Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, high tension with Pakistan, free speech and military funerals, hot politics, and the Nobel Peace Prize goes to a Chinese dissident. In Pakistan, NATO military supply convoys attacked after U.S. military helicopters killed Pakistani troops. Crackling tension there. Here's Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S.
We will take care of all terrorists on the Pakistani side of the border, but we will do it on our timeline.
The Supreme Court tests this father's assertion after religious zealots mar his son's funeral.
For God's sake, it's somebody's funeral. There are limitations with free speech.
And Delaware, GOP Senate candidate Christine O'Donnell was on TV like every candidate across the country right now with a unique challenge.
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you.
I'm you. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Mark Halperin of Time Magazine, where he runs the Page blog, David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor at the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. We'll look later this hour at news of the Nobel Peace Prize going to a jailed Chinese dissident with top China scholar Jerome Cohen. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Fireworks with Pakistan, campaign spending. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Mark Halperin, let me come first to you. In politics, giant money coming into these midterms, we've talked about it, and how much of it is anonymous. Now you've got critics of the GOP saying that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is putting a lot of money into this campaign, is funneling foreign money into campaigns. Is there hard evidence of that, Mark, or just late in the campaign season accusation?
Well, there's hard evidence of it, but money is fungible in the Chamber of Commerce to the extent they take money from foreign sources and spend money on campaigns, and then in effect, they're certainly, you could say they're getting foreign money to influence elections. The president's very unhappy with the Citizens United Supreme Court decision that has changed the landscape of how campaigns get funded. As a political matter, I don't think this will be a cutting issue in the election. I think everyone agrees, even people whose side may be benefiting this cycle, that the campaign finance laws in the wake of that decision are imperfect, and there needs to be, at a minimum, more disclosure and probably a greater restraint on the capacity of people to bring foreign money into our elections.
Republicans say, come on, it's all right. Democrats, unions, spending a lot, too. The president has been really outspoken all the way through from the State of the Union speech on about the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court. Here he is in Maryland yesterday. President Obama is saying unregulated money pouring into the campaigns now threatens more than the Democrats' chances in November.
Groups that receive foreign money are spending huge sums to influence American elections. And they won't tell you where the money for their ads come from. So this isn't just a threat to Democrats. All Republicans should be concerned. Independents should be concerned. This is a threat to our democracy.
A threat to our democracy, says the president. Jack Beatty, there's more than money on the line here. Big differences in the view of government, obviously, between these two parties as we head toward the midterm vote.
Yes, and all taking place in this post-Citizen United world where great floods of money can rush in without any signature on them. I mean, the one hope, we've talked about it before, for somehow reforming the post-Citizen United world was to have the Disclose Act. The Republicans filibustered that, therefore these contributions can remain secret. Effectively, people can buy a company that has some grievance with financial reform can just put $10 million down and no one can know about it. It's a frightening situation. 8,000 ads just up to September 15th taken out by the Chamber of Commerce, nearly all against Democrats. And their money, about $300,000, the American Center for American Progress documents, is in their coffers from foreign donors. It doesn't say that the money has gone to these campaigns, but money is fungible. And that, of course, as the president said, is a threat to democracy. I mean, you almost want to rename the Chamber of Commerce the Chinese Chamber of Commerce, or the Bahraini Chamber of Commerce.
I don't know. I mean, David Ignatius, you follow follow global affairs big time. We're going to look at Pakistan with you. But does this make sense to you, this picture being presented of, you know, foreigners dying to pour money into American congressional campaigns?
Well, what happens in the U.S. Congress matters a lot to countries overseas. If you're China and you see a wave of pressure building up against Chinese exports to the U.S., the idea that China is taking American jobs, and you're going to want in subtle and maybe not so subtle ways to influence that debate. I've been struck looking at this growing hubbub about money in politics by two things. First, it's clear that this Supreme Court is extremely uncomfortable about any limits on political speech, and that includes noxious political speech, as we saw in this fascinating case this week about the protesters at the military funerals. But it also includes limits on corporate political speech and their ability to give to groups. And second, this court increasingly is treating corporations as persons with the same kinds of rights, including First Amendment rights, that individual citizens have. Both those strike me personally as wrong, but that's where this court has been heading for a while.
Mark Halpern, help us understand the politics here. We'll come to the court and the military funeral and the father. We heard him at the top of the hour. But, I mean, you've had Senate Finance Chairman Max Baucus saying, you know, let's look into who's putting money into these nonprofit groups. Let's investigate whether unions and business groups are complying with the tax code requiring that political activity not be their primary purpose. And you've got Republicans pushing back very hard on this. Orrin Hatch, John Kyle saying, no, let's not look at that. I still don't get why that's a winner for Republicans. I mean, don't Republicans want transparency too? Republican voters?
Well, they do, but they have some legitimate concerns regarding the potential misuse of the IRS and getting the IRS involved in looking at people's tax returns for political purposes. Look, there is politics involved here. There's also principled differences. We're also in the midst of a midterm, and I have to say, I'm not minimizing the importance of this to a well-functioning democracy. I'm not minimizing the importance of the president's concerns about it, Citizens United. I do think, both as a matter of political reality and the reality of the lives of Americans, that unemployment, joblessness, the future of our economy is a bigger issue and should be more of the focus. But again, both as a tactical matter for both sides, but also for the good of the country in the next few weeks as we head up to the midterms, because there's got to be a debate that can be resolved to some extent about which economic direction we should go. The question of how our campaigns are funded is always going to be a tough one to work out, and it's not going to be worked out or meaningfully debated in the next few weeks.
Well, it may be debated, but you're right. In the middle of really hot politics, let's go to the substance. I mean, how do we address this economic problem? These new numbers out, what more private hiring, but the net loss because government jobs have gone away. Here's some interesting tape from one of Florida's first of three televised debates. Here's Senate hopeful Mark Rubio, a Tea Party favorite in Florida, saying he would not accept more federal dollars for Florida, even to help build new high-speed rail line there. He said it was a matter of principle.
Nothing is more important than dealing with this long-term debt issue. It is simply unsustainable. And that's not just me saying it. That's the president's advisors telling him that this long-term debt problem our country faces is simply unsustainable. And that's a priority over virtually everything else our country faces. In fact, the national debt is not just a domestic issue. Even people like Hillary Clinton and the leading military commander in this country have said that the national debt has a significant national security component, that our enemies dream of a Greece-like day of reckoning for America.
A Greece-like day of reckoning for America. Jack Beatty, we've got a reckoning right now, however, still, unfortunately, on the economy. How do you see this debate on the substance of, you know, spending, stimulus, go with the deficit, playing out on the hustings, Jack?
Well, in Marco Rubio there, we saw a rare example of a conviction politician. I mean, that's a question. Do you want this high-speed rail in your state that cries out for a fudge? Well, yes, I think there's some way we can accommodate it, and we needn't
right.
be...
It's a lot of money.
Instead, categorically, no, I'm going to turn this down. 28,000 jobs, improve productivity for the future. Nope. On principle, we have to get that budget down. Very, very rare you see that in American politics. He deserves some commendation for that. On the other hand, this is part of a rash of seemingly irrational economic decisions by Republican candidates and or governors. Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, has just said no to a second rail tunnel under the Hudson from New Jersey, which has been in the works for a long time, which the federal government would pay a lot of. He says, no, we can't do it. It would create all kinds of jobs and stimulus. Can't do it. The Republican candidate for governor in Wisconsin says, nope, we can't afford a rail line from Madison to Milwaukee. Just can't afford it. Well, of course, if people in the past had said that, well, we wouldn't have had Hoover Dam. We wouldn't have had the interstate. We wouldn't have had the interstate.
Conestoga wagons to California, Jack?
All of it. I mean, you know, I mean, it's usually infrastructure was thought to be sacrosanct. It's good now. And even better for the future.
How's it playing, if I may, Mark, ask you? I mean, early in the week, the Democrats saw some, you know, tightening, getting closer to Republicans. But then a Gallup poll came out, showed huge margins maybe coming for the GOP in this election. Where's the balance going, Mark Halperin?
Well, there's a few high-profile races where public and private polling show Democrats doing a little bit better. But if you were a betting type, you'd be much smarter to look at this still as a wave election, in which anger at Washington, the president, the Democratic Party, and a perceived overreach on economic issues is going to guide the bulk of the outcomes in House races, which, again, if you were a betting person, you'd say Republicans still win enough seats to take the House and maybe substantially more, enough Senate seats to be within one or two and maybe to take the majority in a lot of governorships, including in some very big states.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a big week in the news at home and abroad. Mark Halperin of Time Magazine is with us, editor-at-large, senior political analyst there, authors the Page blog. His latest book is Game Change, Obama and the Clintons, Palin and McCain, and the Race of a Lifetime. David Ignatius is with us, columnist and associate editor. The Washington Post covers global politics, economics, international affairs. Latest book, The Increment. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go right to Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi. Two things. Number one, this wave, this Republican wave is supposed to be coming. Mm-hmm. It's phony. I don't believe it. I think it's just something made up to pump interest into this thing. It's more of us than it is of them, and we're just as excited to get out and vote.
Why phony this time, Carl? The pollsters are always out there, and they're finding what they're finding. You're not buying it?
I haven't had one person call me. Number two, I find it's been fashionable for the right and Tea Partiers and conservatives to say that President Obama is doing things to destroy this country, but they sit on the sideline while Republicans gladly take foreign money into their coffers to influence our elections. This is something that the president was right on at the State of the Union when he's brung this out. This is something that we as Americans and the federal government need to use every tool. They got to use the IRS to kill this in his crib. We must, because this is an abomination on our country if we allow foreign interest, foreign money, and it's been proven. This is not something that's been made up. It's been proven by the Chamber of Commerce accepting foreign money and funneling it into the Republican Party.
You say proven, and yes, there's foreign money, but they deny straight up and very strongly that it goes into political campaigns. Of course, there is a fungibility factor. Once you've got money, it can go where it will go. But there's no question about your point that it's anonymous, so who knows? Appreciate your call, Carl. One more right here. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts.
Hi. You know, in Tennessee this week, a man's home burned to the ground while firemen sat in their trucks and watched. And that fire really shed a light on the broader battle that's raging over two competing views of government. One says we're a community. The other says you're on your own. Now, most of the focus has been on the fellow whose house burned down because he didn't pay the $75 fee. But I think the broader issue is really illuminated by his neighbor who had paid the fee and had to watch helpless until the fire spread to his property, at which point the firemen put it out. And that really
because
shows
he paid
you,
the fee and she hadn't, yeah.
That's right. That really shows you the idea of a community that the Tea Party is trying to negate. The reason we inoculate the children of illegal immigrants is not just because they deserve it, although they do. It's because everybody else's child who's in school with them deserves to be protected. The purpose of government is to provide and protect a community. And this limited government has really run amok when someone who has paid his fee and is sitting there waiting for the fire department has to wait till his property is actually on fire before they'll do anything about it.
Mark, you're watching closely, and yeah, there's a fee here. That's kind of a wild thing. If you haven't paid it, at least in this instance, the firefighters came to the scene and sat in the truck, watched it burn because it hadn't been paid. But Mark Halperin, there's this. The Tennessee woman whose house it was, is according to, what is this, looks like AP here, says she doesn't blame the firefighters who watched while her house burned to the ground after her family failed to pay a $75 annual protection fee. She says she's okay with it, Mark. So what does that mean about our politics?
Well, there's a day of reckoning coming, not just for the federal government, but for the states, about services we see in the United Kingdom and other countries. This debate going on, and obviously at a time of economic crisis, these are hard decisions to make because there are people hurting, and there's a certain amount of economic stimulus that comes with spending money through the government. So one of the real things at risk in this election is the president will still be the president. There'll be more Republicans in Congress, maybe a lot more. And a lot of governors will face the same thing. How can we have a civil and must be bipartisan discussion about how services should work and how taxes should work? And again, the president talked about putting aside childish things and dealing with our problems. We've had now 18 years of partisanship in the White House in Washington. It's got to change if we're going to address things like that, because people deserve some sort of sense going forward of what the services will be like and what we can afford as a country.
Jack Beatty, our caller Mark says, hey, we're all in this together. But that's not the policy now in this town in Tennessee. If you haven't paid your $75, there's no assurance anymore of that community service for you, even fire department service. But there's the woman whose house burned down saying, well, okay.
Yes, here's a paradigm of individualism run amok. You know, Tocqueville, when he came over here, he said that the genius of the American system was what he calls self-interest rightly understood. And he said, here's the difference between America and Europe. In America, people understand that by abridging their self-interest at the margins, they can gain a greater collective good. In Europe, the classes all go whole hog for everything. The American genius is self-interest rightly understood, and the individualistic Tea Party, I think, is in danger of forgetting that. They're on the Margaret Thatcher sort of continuum. She said in the 80s, there's no such thing as society. Well, of course, there is such a thing as society, and self-interest rightly understood says, If children are inoculated, as Mark said, if fires are put out, that's in your interest too. A neighbor or someone with the children in the school with the inoculated child.
But surely we can thread the needle between all in it together and drowning in debt. There's got to be a way. Big news at home and abroad this week. Eric in Morgantown, Kentucky. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Don. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Long-time listener. And I'd like to agree with your previous callers about everything that's going on. I'm a Democrat in a Republican state in Kentucky.
Okay.
I feel really powerless when I voted for the president because obviously he didn't carry Kentucky, so I just didn't feel as if my vote counted. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Now, what do you see going on this week, Eric?
Well, this week I called the last time whenever the Pakistan thing happened and the helicopter crossed over the fence and shot the guys, and then that night they reported the NATO bombing on the envoy going in, and then you ask if they're enemies or allies. Your friends don't blow up your other friends' trucks. It's got the equipments and the fuels needed to help fight these wars. We're trying to pull out of one war. We're a decade into another war. It looks like we're strapping our boots on for three because the guy that rebutted my call said that, well, we need more boots on the ground, but the Pakistanis are going, hey, we'll handle it on our time or whatever. I don't know when a better time would be. I mean, they're facing the worst crisis they've ever had in their history.
Yeah, you say friends don't do this or that, but of course, it was U.S. helicopters that actually, and not intentionally, but it killed Pakistani soldiers. I guess the Pakistanis might think friends don't do that either, Eric.
Yeah, but, does that justify blowing up fuel and equipment and saying, hey, go away, we'll deal with this on our own?
Let us jump into it. Let us go to it right here. David Ignatius, take us into this. What a mess between the U.S. and Pakistan right now. Help us unthread it if you can.
Well, it is a mess. The tensions that are always inherent in this relationship have really blown up in the last 2 weeks. I was there in Pakistan for part of that time. To illustrate how complicated and in a sense, weird this is, 2 days before U.S. helicopters shot and killed members of the Pakistani Frontier Corps.
Hot pursuit across the border. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hot pursuit across the border, triggering off these torturing of fuel trucks. I was in a little disclosed training camp near the Afghan border where U.S. Special Forces are training members of precisely that same group, the Pakistani Frontier Corps.
In Pakistan you were, and they are, David?
In Pakistan.
Okay,
this is a program that is not talked about, but our special forces are training the Pakistani Frontier Corps to be able to stabilize the tribal areas, which is the buffer zone between Afghanistan and Pakistan. So these are two countries that are getting increasingly angry at each other. President Obama and his aides start the day with a threat briefing and an intelligence analysis. And from what we know, they increasingly are hearing about new scary terror plots against Europe that are hatched in the territory of Pakistan. They go to the Pakistanis almost pleading with the Pakistani intelligence service to do more, to crack down, to go after these people. And again, you have to think what it must be like to start your day that way. In Pakistan, officials start their day reading newspapers that are full of denunciations of America. The Pakistani public is so prickly and angry about what it sees as the violation of its sovereignty. So the two sides, I think, are conditioned for an escalation of tensions and have to be careful that we don't whip ourselves into a state of mind where we really create trouble. We do need Pakistan right now. We are fighting a war across the border. It isn't going well, and it's crucial that we not have to fight, in effect, a two-front war.
Nobody wants to whip up something unnecessary, but let me ask you, David. I mean, because at the same time, you've got to be clear-sighted. The Wall Street Journal reporting this week that while, you know, in Afghanistan, they're beginning to try to actually talk with the Taliban, which might come up with something that would get the U.S. out of there. Wall Street Journal says Pakistan's powerful spy agency is pushing Taliban in the field to keep fighting. Don't go to the talk tables, you know. Kill, kill.
That story was disturbing. I can't, I just don't have the reporting from the U.S. about U.S. views. What I do know is that I talked with a senior official of the Pakistani intelligence agency a week ago and put precisely this question to him, that they want to be sure that they're positioned to play a role in whatever process of negotiation happens across their border to draw the Taliban into a new government. In a sense, that's understandable. It's their neighbor.
Sure, but why does keep fighting help them do that?
I think, again, I haven't done my own reporting on this. I don't want to just echo something.
But I mean, hypothetically,
I think the scary point for us is, are they to gain greater leverage for themselves using these proxies to drag out a process that would otherwise go forward? I don't know that that's true. From what I know about the discussions that are taking place with the Taliban, they're really not. Not quite. They're not yet at the point that you'd say they can lead to any kind of settlement. But you know, the Pakistanis are self-interested. They're acting in ways that are quite ruthless in pursuit of their self-interest, and it's really making people in Washington angry. And I think that's what we're seeing.
Tough report out of the White House this week, and a lot of tough words out of Pakistan. This is just some tape from yesterday. Pakistani Foreign Ministry spokesman Abdul Basit saying that recent U.S. drone attacks, and there have been a lot of those in addition to everything else, have caused a rift with the United States.
We do have strong differences with the U.S. on these attacks as well. And we are, there are ongoing consultations with the U.S. on this issue.
Pentagon trying to put a good face on it. Here's spokesman there, Jeff Morrill, commenting on the apparent rift between the U.S. and Pakistan.
Despite this temporary setback, despite this mistake, this regrettable mistake, relations between our two militaries, at least, remains very strong. I can't speak to the government-to-government relationship, although I suspect, as far as I can tell, that remains strong as well.
Mark Halpern, you follow politics in this country, but this all factors in as we approach an election. What do you see in this U.S.-Pakistan tension and the uncertain, to say the least, progress of the Afghan war?
Well, I mean, I think if you were going to give a report card to this administration in both those theaters, there are some things that have gotten worse and some have gotten better. There do seem to be two elements in place that I think are heartening, and one that is not. The two heartening things are, I think the president has good people there, and I think, unlike some of at the beginning of the administration, there is more of a plan that has the potential to succeed. I remain most worried about the governments there and whether they are going to be reliable or even helpful partners in trying to achieve American objectives. And I think there's no doubt that 2011 is going to involve a bigger debate than we're having in the run-up to these midterms about what national policy should be in both those countries.
Jack, what do you see in the controversy here? David Ignatius writes that part of what President Obama is saying with this White House report, very critical of Pakistan, is talking to the U.S. military. Don't ask me for more troops in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I can well understand that. Well, you know, Bob Woodward's book, I think, casts some very unflattering light on the administration here. He quotes General Lute, who was the military advisor to the White House, saying flat out that the president effectively treated the military and their request for an escalation, the plan that Mark talks about, treated them as a constituency group. What do I have to do to buy you off? Oh, you want a surge? All right, we'll do the surge. And he quotes Leon Panetta as saying, a Democratic president doesn't dare say no to the military, especially a military with the kind of connections to the conservative movement that clearly the leaking going on showed these generals have. So the whole plan at some level was politically motivated. Keep this thing on the burner for another few months so that I don't have to deal with these generals leaking. And the contradictions in the plan that we're on the one hand paying Pakistan, on the other hand, Pakistan is helping our enemies. On the one hand, we're trying to help people trying to help Afghanistan. And on the other hand, as Carl Levin says today, our funding is going to the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Even right around U.S. bases there, Jack.
That's right. That's right. I mean, this policy, this plan is absurd on its face.
Let me go to David. There's a report out today that General James Jones will be resigning as National Security Advisor. Do you see a shift coming in Obama policy on this front?
Well, there's certainly going to be a major shift in personnel. General Jones will leave the White House by the end of the year. I've written that several weeks ago. We also have changes ahead at the Pentagon. Secretary of Defense Bob Gates has said, and I think this time he really means it, that he's going to be resigning sometime next year. I would think it would be in the first half of the year, not the second half. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, his term will end in October, so you'll have a new chairman. So in all these key national security positions, there's an opportunity to get new people. As you make those choices, you've got a war in Afghanistan that is not going well by everyone's account. The most striking discussion of this is a report by the White House itself, which was sent to Congress this last week, which is just devastating in its summary of how the basic metrics, the basic indices of progress are going. So I think we need to look at the personnel appointments with an eye on what kinds of policies will they shape. I do see the administration holding on to its July 2011, let's start withdrawal from Afghanistan timetable. I'm not sure about Jack's comments that this was all political. I saw a president struggling with a question that really tormented him, but kind of straddling the decision in the end.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Philadelphia Phillies pitcher Roy Halladay made history with a super rare playoff no-hitter to beat the Cincinnati Reds.
Had a chopper in front of the plate. Catcher gets and throws, and he has the no-hitter.
TV host Rick Sanchez was fired by CNN for remarks he made about Jon Stewart and Jews.
Everybody who runs CNN is a lot like Stewart, and a lot of people who run all the other networks are a lot like Stewart. And to imply that somehow they, the people in this country who are Jewish, are an oppressed minority? Yeah.
Jon Stewart responded.
Mr. Sanchez was apparently angry at me and our program here for some of the fun that we had poked at his, quite frankly, extremely pokeable show.
And the Nobel Prize in Literature went to Peruvian author Mario Vargas Llosa, first South American to take the prize in nearly three decades. Here he is yesterday talking about the big phone call.
They say, you have been honored with the Nobel Prize of Literature. No more explanations. I didn't ask for any explanation. You know? I think what he told me was enough, you know.
Sounds pretty happy there. Not so happy in official Chinese circles, where the Nobel Peace Prize went to human rights activist Liao Xiaobo. Mark Halperin is with us from Time Magazine today, David Ignatius from The Washington Post, and Jack Beattie. Here's just from today. In Oslo, Norway, chairman of the Norwegian Nobel Committee announcing the winner of the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2010 to Liu Xiaobo for his long and non-violent struggle for fundamental human rights in China.
Mark Halperin and David Ignatius, Jack, please stand by. We're very happy to be joined right now from New York by Jerome Cohen, one of the world's leading authorities on China's legal system, professor at NYU School of Law, senior fellow for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Jerome Cohen, thank you very much for being here on this day.
Delighted to be with you, Tom.
The last time you and I sat down and talked, we were doing the show in Shanghai. We talked about Liu Xiaobo and his circumstances there. Now he's got the Nobel Peace Prize. Gosh, it raises a lot of questions. What's your first response to this?
Well, my first response is, what will be the response of the Chinese government? We already know they have condemned the Nobel Committee because they say they have given the award inappropriately to a criminal. And they defend their conviction and sentence to 11 years in prison of Liu by saying he was trying to subvert the Chinese state because he helped to organize a document that called for peaceful change in China's political system and the kinds of political reform that many, many people in and out of China have long felt China needs.
China called this a blasphemy. Before the award was even named, they had reportedly, a senior Chinese official had kind of threatened Norway, don't do this or your country will pay. What does that mean?
Well, that backfired. That was counterproductive. Chinese diplomats often are too zealous in trying to carry out Beijing's orders. Norway is better insulated than any other country in fending off Chinese pressures. It has the highest per capita income of any country in the world, as well as the world's respect on many grounds. So I think Norway will survive this flap.
What does Mr. Liu stand for in China?
Liu Xiaobo?
Yes.
Well, he stands, in the eyes of all who are permitted to know about him, for the practice of democracy and for the practice of the rule of law. The problem has been, because of severe internal controls on transparency, most people in China have never heard of him, nor have they heard of Charter 2008, which was the document that he did so much to foster, even though maybe 300,000 people eventually knew about it and tried to adhere to it. But this does more to let the people of China know about Liu Xiaobo and Charter 08 than anything that has yet been done. The prize will reach almost everybody in China because the government media cannot suppress it.
How will that happen? We went to main Chinese news sites this morning, and there wasn't a word about it. There was word on, you know, fashion garment production, but nothing about this. I mean, and Liu's own wife says he won't know because, you know, he's incommunicado in prison. Will the Chinese people at large know how? And what about
that's
him?
One of the interesting questions, will he know and how? When another famous and deserving activist named Hu Jia was awarded the European Parliament Sakharov Prize, the Chinese government sent somebody to his prison to inform him because they tried to dissuade him from accepting the prize. They wanted him to reject it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they'll be so foolish in dealing with Liu Xiaobo. But whether he learns about it or not, given the porousness of the Internet in China and the variety of ways people have of getting this information about. And there's something about the Nobel Peace Prize that carries a lot more weight than other distinguished prizes for human rights, like the Sakharov Prize the Philippines Magsaysay Prize, which another great activist named Chun Guangcheng, was awarded and again was not permitted to go, and his wife wasn't permitted to go either.
I know I've only got you for another minute or so. Let me just give you a couple pieces of reaction from our listeners here for your reaction. Here's just two from the website. There's one from Jack, says, as a Chinese, I'm glad for Mr. Liu Xiaobo's winning of the Nobel Peace Prize. It will help open up the political reform in China. However, the process should still be slow, he writes. The number one need for most Chinese is still economic growth, and the Communist Party has done an excellent job on that. That's a Chinese response, I guess. And then here's one more on Facebook from Robert, says, the Liu Xiaobo news is by far the biggest news, as the People's Republic of China was screaming already about it. They do not hesitate to resort to bullying. It's a bad sign of how things will be when they take over. How do you respond to those?
Well, I think the first suggestion is clearly right. The party has done an enormous amount for economic development in China, China's progress. The one thing he doesn't note, however, is the huge gap that has developed between the rich and the poor. China used to have the best so-called Gini ratio, a narrow gap between rich and poor, when people weren't very rich.
Right.
But now you have a huge gap, and that's created a great deal of dissonance, petitions, protests, which have in turn caused enormous repression in China. And one of the things Liu Xiaobo was advocating was orderly, peaceful, gradual change. But change. He was not advocating violent overthrow of the government.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to depict him as though he was somebody advocating violence. And they say, oh, even in the United States, one can be convicted for advocating violent overthrow of the government.
But he's in prison for 11 years, sentence anyway, for proposing, pushing orderly change. Last question for you, Jerome Cohen. Will Liu Xiaobo ever stand before, you know, that grand scene in Oslo to receive this prize? Will that ever happen?
Well, if they make some flexible arrangement for him to turn up in the future, I think it will happen. I don't think he'll last 11 years. Two years from now, China will have another change in the party leadership, something of a new generation. These people, we hope, we always have hope, will be more responsive to the importance of political change to accompany its tremendous economic change. He'll get there someday, but I don't think it will happen in the immediate.
Jerome Cohen at NYU School of Law in New York, you're always terrific. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
David Ignatius, how do you see this big award factoring into the U.S.-China tension that is higher than usual lately?
Well, I think it's going to add to it. What I'm struck by is the growing pressure from the international community, and not the traditional U.S. Advocates and hectors of people, that China can form more to international norms. Here you have the Nobel Committee in Oslo choosing someone in prison, despite Chinese warnings. Chinese said in the weeks running up to this award, don't give the prize to this guy. Don't do this. We really don't want you to do this. At the same time, you have the International Monetary Fund in Washington today exerting considerable pressure on China to lower the value of its currency, to do what it's said, which is to play by the market rules of international finance. The IMF is headed by a Frenchman, Dominique Strauss-Kahn. He has support widely on the IMF board. So you're seeing, I think, a much broader than has been the case coalition internationally saying to China, you cannot write the rules yourselves. You're now an economic superpower. You're a decisive force in the world. You have to understand global norms.
And yet they've got the weight of 1.5 billion people in their own country to deal with, as Jerome Cohen and our communicants say.
They do, but I don't think the Chinese are comfortable being as isolated as they are. I have a feeling the Chinese will know about this award. If the government tries to crack down even harder, it will have bad repercussions. I mean, they're walking a fairly delicate tightrope themselves, and I think they understand that.
Let's bring it home. Big free speech battle this week before the Supreme Court as members of the Westboro Baptist Church in Kansas defended their right to picket outside a fallen Marine's funeral. Jan Crawford of CBS News challenged a protester, one of them. You'll hear Crawford first.
What gives you the right to protest in front of someone's funeral?
Do you understand what a public right-of-way is? What gives you the right to cover that funeral? What gives you the right to run a news story about it? I tell you, pick me. The First Stinking Amendment.
The First Amendment. Mark Halperin, I can't remember a hotter Supreme Court case than this. I mean, the emotion's so high. Of course, they put a pretty hot poker into these funeral scenes, and people have seen it. It's tough to watch, but there's the First Amendment.
Well, it's an emotional issue, and it's one where the current makeup, justices who make up the Supreme Court, it's not clear ideologically or in terms of principle where people will come down. I suspect that in the end, this court, and as you will and should, give deference to free speech, even though there is a lot of emotion involved.
The L.A. Times here, Jack Beatty, saying they think may be inclined to rule against the funeral protesters. They're out there with signs saying, thank God for IEDs at a time when those are killing and have killed many, many American soldiers. And, of course, their issue is, one of many, is the growing tolerance of homosexuality in this country. And so they take it to this extreme. What do you see here, Jack?
Well, the veterans, the family, is arguing that there's a captive audience exception to free speech, that when you're in you're in your home and people are picketing outside, you're a captive audience, and therefore you really have no liberty to remove yourself from that situation. And they say this is comparable to that. It requires a restriction on speech. On the other hand, the Phelps say we're 1,000 feet away. You don't have to look at us. And I was struck by one thing that Margie Phelps, the lawyer for the family, said. She said, there are 310 million people on one side and there are 80 of us on the other, and the First Amendment protects us. Now, I think what they did was odious, but I love that idea of defending heresy, even the kind of speech that offends 310 million people.
Pretty raw, pretty ragged speech. Let's hear from our listeners. Naugatuck, Connecticut. Dave, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, hi, but I think if Wipro or SADM or the U.S. the Indian Chamber of Commerce wants to give money to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and put an ad on the news to defend outsourcing displacement of IT workers, I don't understand. It's like crying fire in a crowded theater. I mean, there's some kinds of speech that need some degree of control, and our forefathers recognize. I mean, our forefathers. We're talking about natural persons and free speech. It was a former railroad guy, J. Bancroft Davis, a law clerk, who invented the concept in the case note of a corporation being a person. The judges never, in that key case, you go on Wikipedia, corporate person, the judges never said a corporation was a natural person.
Wait a minute, Dave. The protesters at the funerals, take it to them. Do you see, are there protests crying free speech, crying fire in a theater? Is that what you're saying or not?
I think they are. Yes, I think that there are reasonable limits on free speech. I can't go out and slander, I can't go slander the Polaroid Corporation and not expect anything to happen. I
mean, we hear it, Dave. Let me get one more. Vincennes, Indiana. Jack, you're on the air.
Hey.
Hi, Jack. What do you think? What do you think?
Well, I wanted to put in my two cents on the protesters at the funeral.
Yeah, are you? Do they have a right to do it as hard as it is to see and hear?
I'm a pretty conservative fellow.
Okay,
I think those people have a right to protest. I mean, it is free speech. There's no two ways about it. It is free speech. We may not like what we're hearing, but it's their right to say it.
What if it was your son or daughter's funeral and they had died for their country in Iraq or Afghanistan? What about that, Jack?
I wouldn't be happy about it. I wouldn't be happy about hearing those things in my face like that. But they do have a right to say what they want to say, and I can see how there might be some merit to having an area set aside for them to protest that would not be within the earshot of the people who are in their...
In the funeral, yeah, and there pretty much was 1,000 feet, I believe, in this case, and still there's the debate right there in those two calls. One more, Burlington, Vermont. Harry, you're on the air. Harry, keep it short.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the whole Rick Sanchez firing. I called a while back when this whole WikiLeaks thing broke, and I commented about the Rick Sanchez show and stating specifically how that his show is really the equivalent of America's Funniest Home Videos, and it was just, I'm so happy that he's no longer on CNN, and I wish that other news organizations would get on board and give us real anchors, something to the effect of getting, you know, NPR on television, more serious news, because the state of CNN right now is a mess, and I think that firing him was just fantastic.
Harry, I appreciate your call. Mark Halperin, give us your view on this one. You know, he had his comments, and he's gone. How do you read it, Mark?
I'm sorry. He had his what?
His comments that we just played coming into this segment on Jon Stewart and the American media, and now Rick Sanchez is off CNN. What do you make of that whole turnabout?
Well, I mean, he apologized and said he shouldn't have said what he said, and I think that from a media point of view, there's a lot of chaos or I'm missing the word I want. CNN is grappling with how they want to program throughout the day, and I think. I think there's going to be more changes there before they settle down.
More changes. There's one. He's gone. We don't get to Lou Dobbs. Maybe another time. But I'm grateful to each of you for being with us on the big issues today. Mark Halperin with Time Magazine. Got the Page blog there. Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And David Ignatius with the Washington Post, just back from Pakistan, Afghanistan. David, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, same to you. Thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.